welcome to Wild Connection, the podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Jennifer Vertelin. I'm a scientist and author that studies animal behavior. I'm passionate about animals, and I love helping people reconnect with nature to live better lives. This podcast is about you, other animals, and how we're all connected in this wild and crazy thing called life. Hey everybody, welcome back to Wild Connection, the podcast. This is a special episode because it marks the end of the Voices of Uganda series, but it doesn't mark the end of bringing you more people that live and work there. Today, we're going to talk about coffee, the thing that so many of us love and crave. Today, coffee is grown all over the world, but it originates in Ethiopia, and its history is recounted in the mythology of a goat herder who noticed that his goats became very energetic after eating the fruits. If you don't know anything about goats, they're pretty energetic already, so they must have really changed their behavior. We too can get the jitters from coffee, and soon coffee was being cultivated. It's now a billion-dollar industry, but few people are connected to where their cup of coffee comes from. In this episode, I talk with Kingsley Griffin, founder of Kinga Coffee Company, an organic coffee farm and coffee producer in southwestern Uganda. Before we get to the interview, I want to invite you to check out the show notes where you can see photos and find a link to a video of me processing coffee the old-fashioned way. I did that last year in celebration of International Coffee Day. Now, you can find the show notes on my website, jennifervertelin.com, or on the podcast website, Wild Connection, the podcast hosted by Podbean. I caught up with Kingsley and Windy, and we chatted as we looked out to the forest that both of us love. All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. As you know, I'm bringing you a special series, Voices of Uganda. And today I have with me a really amazing person. His name is Kingsley Griffin.
Yeah, it's me.
And he is the owner and founder of an organic coffee farm, Kinga Coffee Estate. Mm-hmm. And we are sitting here looking out at beautiful, windy, impenetrable forest. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for having me on. It's nice to be here. Beautiful view too, huh?
Yes. And you know, I'd been drinking your coffee and then it was such a pleasant surprise to meet you.
Yeah, it was great. Just, here I am, and we got together. It worked out well.
It did. And so you're here. And before we start talking about the specifics of your coffee farm and some of the really incredible work that you're doing, not just with coffee, but with communities, I'd love for people to get a little bit of a sense about who you are, where you come from, and then we'll get to how you ended up here in southwestern Uganda.
In this small little corner of the world. Yeah, for sure. I'd love to share a bit about my background stories. I was born in the U.S., and we traveled quite a bit as a family, back and forth between West Coast and East Coast, and then ended up in a small town near Toronto called Elmer, Ontario. And then I went to high school near there for about 5 years. And then I decided I wanted to go out west to mountains, so I went to UBC in Vancouver. And when I was there, I realized that I wanted to see the world, do a bit of traveling. And a friend of mine recommended a program in Australia, in fact, to do a degree in education. So I went from studying at UBC, and then I went down to Australia for a year and a half and did a master's in education down there and got into teaching from that point. And so I thought that teaching sort of fit what I wanted to do because I was able to travel and earn an income and meet lots of good people and see the world. And so it just made sense. They kind of fit really well together. So I did a year and a half in Australia, and when I left there, I moved to England for 4 years, lived in Oxford for 4 years and taught at various primary schools in Oxford. And from there, I moved from Oxford to Dubai in about 2009. I got to Dubai, spent about 9 years in Dubai, 8 or 9 years. And then from Dubai, I moved to Uganda, 3 years in Uganda. And then from Uganda, I moved to back to Vancouver, actually, which is where I currently live with my family now.
That's what a journey. Around the world.
Around the world, literally. Yeah.
So when you initially came to Uganda, were you here as a teacher, as an educator?
No, I was working at a school in Dubai. I was lucky enough to work at a school for Emiratis. It's called Rashid School for Boys. And, you know, as you know, if you're a teacher, you have all this time off. You've got Christmas off and summertime off and you know, Easter and all the breaks you get. And my wife, she and I decided to come to Uganda to see the mountain gorillas, which is obviously your reason for being here as well.
Exactly. So, many people come here for that reason.
They do. So we came for the mountain gorillas, and then you did 2 days up here in Bawindi, and then we went down to Ishasha for the lions and the elephants and the hippos and the leopards and all those wonderful things down there. So my initial interest in here was just, as most people do come as a tourist.
I got to ask, because maybe people are wondering, I know I'm wondering, how did you transition? Or what motivated you to shift from education to coffee?
That's a good question. I ask myself that one a lot of the time. I wake up and I think, how did I go from one thing to something completely different in a completely different part of the world? I mean, Uganda, Bawindi, which is, you know, I'm sure you put on a map at some point, it's the middle of almost nowhere. There's the road ends. Yep. There's the park and there's the end of the road. This is a far cry from the high rises of Dubai. And so to make that jump, I think to myself, you know, what got me here? And what do you do to make that huge leap? And for me, it was the kids, actually. It was the kids in Uganda and my interest in education. And somehow the two kind of met. And I'd be happy to tell the story of how it all sort of started.
Oh, please. Absolutely.
So we came, like I said, I came to see the gorillas and the lions and everything else. But part of the time that we were here, my wife and I did a small walk around the village. And we came to a school called St. Matthew's Primary School. And the kids were, you know, beautiful kids, smiling faces, just bright, happy kids. And we spent a couple hours with the school. And we gave them a little bit of money for assistance for whatever they could do. And I said, guys, thank you very much for your time. I really appreciate it. Thank you for all you've shown me. Maybe someday I'll come back. Here's my email address. And if our paths cross again, I'd love to help you out. And so that was sort of the beginning of this. And we flew back to Dubai as a family, and we got there, my wife and I, and we got there. And shortly after returning, I got an email from the school saying, hey, thanks for the donation, but how about you donate a whole bunch more?
Right? Not an unusual request.
No, not really. I mean, it's fairly standard, I think. And so they said, how about you give us a couple $1,000? And yeah, I've been hesitant to send a few $1,000 to somebody's email address I had met for a couple hours.
Sure.
But I thought, I do have this time off as a teacher. I have my you know, Christmas, Easter, summertime. So I called the school and said, what about we do this? What if I spend the next 4 or 5 months fundraising through friends, family, community, schools, and we'll see if we can get a few $1,000 together and maybe some uniforms and some school supplies. And I will come in the summer and I'll take my summer off and I'll come and I'll live with you guys. And then we can do the projects together. And they said, great, you know, come on down. I said, can you just find me a house and a place to stay? And I'm happy to come down and spend my summertime with you guys. We'll do whatever you want to do. And they said, sure, we'd love to have you. So I hopped on a plane, you know, raised a bunch of money, hopped on a plane, flew down here, got off the plane in the small little airport, the little airstrip, which you've been to.
Chihihi
airstrip. Yeah, it's a little, it's a little dirt track, right?
Yes, so it's a bit smoother than some of the other ones.
It is, actually. It's just a little more high end than the other ones, which is just a grassy field or even less. Yeah.
Yes.
So we fly into the Chihihi and they meet me and I get in the car and I say, okay, let's go up. And they said, no, before you go, you have to buy a bed. So I don't understand. What do you mean I've got to buy a bed? And they said, before you can leave the small town of Chihihi, you need a place to sleep tonight. So I understand, but is there not a bed where I'm going? They said, no, you've got to buy a bed, you've got to buy a mattress, but we have to go to the woodworking shop and you can pick out the parts you want and they'll put the bed together. But okay, this is welcome to Uganda, right?
Bring your own bed is another acronym for BYOB.
It is. So we get in the car and go to the carpenter, and the carpenter's like, there's a headboard, there's a, you know, a footboard, there's the railings, there's the slats. How big are you? Let's measure you know, I'm 6'3", so kind of big for Ugandan bed. So they made a bed that fit my size, and he said, it's going to be a couple $100. Okay, I guess that's part of the deal. So I bought a bed. And I said, now what? He said, now the bed will come in a couple hours on a truck. You just go up to, you know, your room. Okay, great. So we drove up to the place I was staying and pull up to this little house on the side of the road and walk down the path to the house. And it's this small little place and there's no running water, no electricity and nothing else. Just two rooms and nothing. No furniture.
No toilet.
No, there's a toilet.
Okay.
There is a small little drop place.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, a drop place.
A drop place. Yeah. And you have to, it flushes, but you got to fill it full of water. So there's a jerry can. So you fill the jerry, you fill the toilet full of water and you flush it and then it goes down and wherever it goes, it goes. Mm-hmm. And so they had that and they did have they had these two rooms as well, but there was nothing in the rooms. Okay. Totally empty. And I said, is there a shelf or maybe a chair or even like a stool? And they said, no, but the bed's coming.
So it's a good thing you bought a bed.
So it's a good thing I bought a bed. And I said, now what? And they said, now you just wait and a couple hours the bed will come and then you go to sleep and in the morning we'll see you. I thought, okay, I guess that's how you do it. So I waited and the bed came and then the mattress came and then some sheets came and somebody came and put it all together and they said, here's a mosquito net, see you in the morning. And that was it. That was my first experience with living, like actually living here proper in Uganda. And it was, remember that first night, I was lying in bed. Nobody knew where I was, except apart from one person. And there's all these noises on the roof, you know, lizards and monkeys and different kinds of birds. But I was kind of terrified because it was pitch black, no light, no anything, no electricity. And it's okay if you're used to it, but if you're not used to it, it can be a bit shocking at first.
Oh, yes.
Right? So it was a long night. And then the morning came and they knocked on the door and knock, knock, knock. And they said, time to go to the school. I said, okay, I guess we go to the school now. I got up, put some clothes on, went to the school and spent the next 6 weeks building goat sheds and building gardens and planting cabbage and corn and spinach and kale and trying to figure out what the kids need for a balanced diet. So we spent the next 6 months doing 6 weeks doing these projects. And at the end of 6 weeks, we had a great vegetable garden that fed the entire school, which was fantastic. Had a goat shed where they could raise female goats and get milk to make cheese. And when the goats reach a certain age, then obviously you slaughter the goat and you've got some meat for some protein for the kids' diet. So all these programs were great. And then along with my time as a teacher, I did a lot of teacher training in the classrooms, a lot of just teaching with the kids. And also had brought with me a bunch of uniforms from the school I was working at. Had given me a couple hundred uniforms. So we gave those to the kids as well.
Okay.
So it was a really successful 6 weeks. And so that was kind of how I got into Uganda. And then coffee comes sort of from that.
Okay.
So
all right.
What we did, what I did actually is when in the evenings here, as you know now, there's not a whole lot to do.
No.
Like it's beautiful here. It's gorgeous. And there's mountains everywhere. So what are you going to do? You go hiking.
Yeah. Yes. But that's during the day. And since we're on the equator, you know, it's like there's not a whole lot of variation in daylight and darkness. It's kind of constant.
Tick, tick, tick. Yeah. So it was like, I guess I'd volunteer all day around like 3 or 4. We'd kind of finish for the day. And I had this sort of late afternoon, early evening. And I'd go hiking in the hills because I thought, okay, you know, I'd go see the area and hike up. And there's some beautiful views. If you get high enough up, you can see, you know, the rainforest. You can see the volcanoes and Tesoro in the distance.
Yes.
It's gorgeous.
It is. It is beautiful.
So I'd hike and I'd hike and I'd hike and I noticed there's coffee growing and everyone's got a garden, you know, 1 acre, half an acre. All the local residents have these small little gardens where they grow coffee and they grow bananas and they grow cassava and they grow, what else do they grow? Beans and ghee nuts, all the things they need to survive. And coffee is the cash crop, but it grows very sporadically, a couple of trees here, a couple of trees there. And I started thinking to myself, what if somebody were able to kind of standardize how it's done as a project, and then you could run that project and use the proceeds from that to kind of help the community, so that my time here would be spent with the 6 weeks volunteering, and I'd have 2 weeks at the end to try and sort out this little mini project. And by that time, my wife had come and we were together. So we started looking at lands, and with the idea that if we could find a decent piece of land, what we would do is get a bunch of coffee and do much more of a standardized system of growing it, where it would be, you know, row on row on row on row on row. And it takes about 3 years for coffee tree to grow. And in that time, I'd come and go and help them develop the coffee farm. And after the 3 years, when the coffee was ready to harvest, the local community could use that in any way they saw fit for their own benefit.
Okay. And so we're going to circle back to how that went and how you first, you know, when you first started planting coffee.
Hmm.
But I kind of want to, you know, you mentioned you came here, you guys came as a family, mountain gorillas, all the other wildlife, and then you spent time hiking and hiking. And so I'm curious,
you know, had you had any experience farming as a child or in your family?
I mean, no, not really. I grew up in the country in kind of southwestern Ontario. There was behind me was a soybean field. In front of me was a cornfield. To my left was a forest, and to my right was another field. So I was surrounded by farms. We weren't farmers as a family, but there was farms everywhere. Not that that teaches how to farm, but I grew up kind of in a rural area, so I had an idea of what farming was and what it meant, but I didn't have any experience as an actual farmer.
Okay. And so I was kind of wondering, you know, how you connected to nature when you were younger, and how that may have played a role in wanting to come back here in such a beautiful area.
Yes.
And start your project.
That's a great, great question. It actually, when I think about it, I always wanted to work outdoors. And part of the reason I enjoyed teaching was you can take the kids outside and you can do activities outside and you can play games and you can do educational activities. And if you have, you know, the time and the energy for it, you can do a lot of the education actually outdoors. And so I loved that part of teaching, loved being outside. And as a kid, I spent 6 summers up in Northern Ontario at a place called Taylor Statton Camps as a canoe tripping guide and as a counselor. So I had all these summers of outdoor experience, paddling on these lakes with kids and nobody else around. Beautiful, beautiful place. I developed like a love of nature. And then when I came here and saw the greenery and the hills and just how beautiful it is and how clean it is here, it was an easy fit. Just the nature kind of, it just sort of fit.
Yeah.
Really easily.
Because not everybody, you know, feels, not everybody has this force resonate with them.
No.
And so I was kind of curious. Right?
Yeah.
Okay. So, and I also think people don't realize how important of a cash crop coffee is for Uganda. You know, I'm not terribly familiar with the history of coffee in Uganda. Can you give us a little bit of background about that?
Yeah, coffee here is the number one cash crop in the country. And everybody, almost every family I've met, every farmer I've met in my time here, they have coffee. Whether it's Arabica or Robusta, they have coffee. And coffee is cash. In some ways, coffee is life in some ways for these guys, because they will grow the coffee, pick the coffee, and then use that to pay school fees, use that to buy clothes, use that to buy food. So they have subsistence crops, but coffee in itself in the country and for the history of coffee here, as far as I understand, has been used as a cash crop. And so they almost use it like a currency. And in the really busy coffee season, you can buy and sell products using coffee as the currency.
Okay. Okay. And now you mentioned Robusta and Arabica, two different, very different types of coffee.
Yeah.
First of all, you bought a beautiful piece of land. How did you find that particular piece? And I'm getting to go tomorrow. So
yes, I can't wait.
I'm very excited.
Fun.
Yes. Yeah. How did you find this particular piece of land, and what about it spoke to you for this is where your coffee would be?
Yeah, that's it. I don't even know. It was a long time developing. It took us quite a while to find a piece of land. So from Dubai to here is about a 4.5-5 hour flight. And it's not too expensive if you go back once in a while. And so I would come between when I first came here to see the gorillas and I left and came back to volunteer and left again. I'd fly here if I had a weekend or a long weekend or 4 or 5 days. I'd fly here, get a visa at the airport. It used to be visa on arrival. They just stamp you at the airport, in you go. I'd come up here to Bawindi and just start looking at land. And if you ask somebody, can you help me find land? They're generally more than happy to tag along and say, this is for sale, this is for sale. But it's difficult sometimes if you don't know what you're doing, how to navigate that whole land sale process. So
yes, I am very aware of that.
It can be challenging to say the least. So it took me about a year and a half of looking at land to find a piece that I liked, and to get the piece verified by the different people and governing bodies and legal channels and all that, to make sure that what I was getting was actually for sale, first of all, and was actually the piece that I was looking at, and then matched the title that they had. And you have to verify everything piece by piece by piece. And it takes a long time, and each step takes how long it takes, and you have to wait till you finish step one before you can do step two. And because I wasn't living here, I was just coming and going. It was mostly done with emails and phone calls. I'd come, Look at land. No, that doesn't work. Look at land. That doesn't work. And I finally found one that actually had a title that they were willing to cut a chunk of the land out and give it to me. But when I bought it, it was covered in eucalyptus trees and just kind of scrubby crops, scrub brush. And I didn't actually see the view or the piece of land itself. I walked it a few times and thought, okay, it's the right size. Let's just do this without really understanding how it actually looked.
Yeah. Yeah. And I've seen pictures and it's spectacular.
Yeah. So luckily, I mean, really, really lucky. When we cleared, I didn't actually do this. When I bought the land, I accepted ownership of it. And I assumed that everything on the land came with that ownership. But I learned a quick lesson and got into business that once I had purchased the land and left back to the UAE, when I was there getting ready to come back again, all the stuff that I'd bought that was on the land was cut down and taken by whoever was around. So I assumed all that stuff was going to be mine to use to do the project and to build this and build this, but that's not the case apparently if you're not around and you don't watch this stuff. So I came back and it was all cleared, and it worked out really well because I came back, it was clear, and there's this incredible view, like this beautiful view from this piece of land which I hadn't seen before. And so it rolls down the hill, there's a river at the bottom, and you can see Congo, you can see Lake Edward, you can see the Rubenzori Mountains, you can see Mount Stanley. I mean, incredible view. And I had no idea. So I came back and I was a little bit like, oh, I guess my trees are gone. But at the same time, this incredible view. So you win some, you lose some.
Sure, so. Sure. And I guess in some way, the work was done for you.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering, so how does someone who's never, you know, planted coffee and grown coffee, you know, what was the process for securing coffee plants and planting them? And did you learn any difficult lessons with that as well?
Yeah, I mean, the difficult lessons I'm still learning. that learning curve will go on forever.
I know. I think I'm a few years behind you, but
you'll get there.
I'm getting there.
Good question. So what I did was once they had cleared the land for me, bless their hearts, I went to the Uganda Coffee Development Authority, the UCDA, and I said, I've purchased this 20-acre piece of land, and my intention is to put coffee on the land. And when the coffee reaches year three or year four, I want to then turn all that over to the local community, and they can harvest it and find the market and sell the coffee, et cetera, et cetera. And so the Ugandan Coffee Authority said, great, we'd love to help you. Give us your location. So I sent them the location and they said, the next couple of days, coffee will show up. We'll call you when it's coming. Somebody called me and said, it'll be there tomorrow. So went out to the land, and then in the morning a truck shows up with 20,000 coffee trees. Literally, 20,000 coffee trees just shows up.
Okay.
They honk the horn, pull into the land, and they say, here's your coffee. I said, okay, now what? They said, we don't know, but here's your coffee. We were just told to deliver it.
20,000?
20,000 coffee trees.
My goodness.
Yeah. So they showed up, and I thought, well, I need to learn how to do this real quick.
Yes.
I've only got a few more weeks here. If I have to go back to Dubai, what am I going to do? So I started on the internet, as you do, researching coffee farms, coffee plantations, coffee growing, coffee, everything coffee, as fast as I could, trying to learn.
It is the benefit of being an educator. You can assimilate information pretty rapidly.
You hope so.
Yes.
Yeah. So I taught myself as fast as I could. And then I called these guys back at the Uganda Coffee Authority and said, thank you for the 20,000 trees. This is what I've learned in the last little while from researching, but I really need somebody to come here and at least give me a day showing me how to turn what I've learned in theory into practice. Can you please come? And they said, yeah, we'll send somebody. And lo and behold, they sent somebody. And this guy came and he brought this triangle-shaped piece of wood. So you imagine a triangle with a little stick in the middle. And from that, there's a rock hanging. And that's when the rock is hanging from a string. And so you have this little triangle stick with the rock hanging from a string. And you put that in the ground. And when the rock doesn't sway back and forth, the ground's level. And this triangle is designed so it's from one leg of the triangle to the other is 2 meters apart, 1.5 meters, 2 meters apart. And so that's the spacing for coffee trees.
Oh.
So you take this triangular shaped piece of wood with two kind of legs on the bottom, and you have to stick that in the ground, and then you put one coffee tree where one leg is, you dig a hole where the second leg is, and that's your spacing. And when the rock isn't swinging, that's your level.
Okay.
So then you take that and you go piece by piece by piece across the land.
Wow.
So it's crazy labor intensive.
Yes. And with 20,000.
20,000. So you got to dig 20,000 holes. So then you have to get people to come dig 20,000 holes. Because there's no mechanized labor. It's all hand done. So these, I went down to the village and I said, I'd like some help digging 20,000 holes. Does anybody want to come help me? And they said, yeah, sure. But how much are you going to pay us?
Of course.
And I had no concept of the value of time and work here. Sure. Because I'd only just bought this piece of land and I'd come as a tourist. So my understanding of what the time money equation was very minimal. And I thought, okay, well, you tell me what's fair. I don't know. So,
oh no. So I've done that quite a bit.
Right? It's tough when you say you tell me, because then the numbers go everywhere. Everyone's shouting different numbers at you. This. You think this can't be the way to do it. This doesn't make any sense. So, okay, well, how about we do this? How about I pay you this much per day? Because I took the highest number, they were yelling at me, the lowest number that was being shouted at, and I thought, okay, somewhere in the middle may be what it's actually worth. So let's take this random number. I think it was, I don't know, maybe 15,000 shillings, which is about $3 US per day to come dig these holes. So okay, so we shook hands, we agreed. The following day, 25, 30 people show up and they get to the front, the gate of the front area, and they sit down and say, where are our shovels? Where are our hoes? And where's our lunch?
I was just going to say, did you factor in lunch?
I had no idea.
It's amazing you didn't have to pay for transportation.
I mean, they walked, thankfully, from the village. They walked up. Otherwise, yes.
No, but you know,
Even that. So they said, what about lunch? And coming from, again, from, you know, North America and UAE, whatever else, you just bring your own lunch to work. You
know, sure.
You brown bag it or you find lunch somewhere around, but lunch is not usually included as part of any job that you take. Some jobs, but in general, not usually. And I thought, I don't know how to feed 25 people. So again, you tell me. What do we do for lunch? And they said, you have to get a cook and saucepans and cups and bowls and plates and forks and knives and cook us the following g-nuts and beans and pocho and
matoke,
this whole list of things.
Goat stew or no?
The goat stew or beef stew or sometimes pork stew for sure. I mean, the food's really nice when you cook all these beautiful stews with the flavors and things together. It's fantastic. The food, when you put the stew together, it tastes really good. But I was unaware of any of this. I just thought you'd come, you'd dig some holes, I'd pay you the agreed wage, and then you'd go back the following day, dig more holes, and after X number of days, we'd have 20,000 holes and we could put the trees in. But no, it's not quite that easy. So now I own saucepans, and I own forks, and knives, and spoons, and cups, and bags of pocho, and sacks of beans, and things of bananas, and matoki, and all this sort of stuff. And it's all kind of fun anyway. I mean, it's a learning experience. I'm having a good time, smiling, and so all the food comes, and we... Now what? Now get us a cook. Okay, who wants to cook? Somebody raises their hands. Okay, you're now the cook. Right? So then you've now hired people to dig. You've hired a cook. You've bought the food. Now you're ready to go. You know, but this takes a little while to navigate all this. And you have no idea what you're doing to start with. And so now they're ready to go. And they start digging the holes. And again, another lesson I learned quickly was if you pay for a day's labor, oftentimes the pace of work is quite slow.
I mean, I anticipated this coming when you said for the day.
Yeah, by the day. So,
because now they're getting lunch, they're getting paid by the day.
Yeah.
What reason do you have to make it end?
Yeah, it's great, right? I can come here every day and I can make good money and I can get a meal. And I'm very happy to do these things, but I just didn't understand how it's supposed to happen.
Of course.
So after watching... And the holes you dig for coffee is 2 feet by 2 feet by 2 feet.
Okay.
So 2 feet long, 2 feet wide, 2 feet deep.
Okay.
So it doesn't take that long. And the soil is pretty loose. So it doesn't take long to dig a hole. But it was taking these guys a very long time to dig one hole. So I thought, listen, this may take months. And that doesn't make any sense because the seedlings are going to go bad. They're in these little seedling bags.
Sure.
We have to get them in the ground. So, okay, everyone stop. We're going to pay you on a per hole basis. So... In a day, you can probably dig this many holes, so we'll give you this much money per hole. Oh, no, it's not. Again, back to negotiating. Everyone puts the tools down and sits there and says, we're not doing anything. So we negotiate again and negotiate again, and we finally agree on a price that makes sense to dig every individual hole. And after all this, finally we get 20,000 holes dug in the ground.
Okay.
And then comes 20,000 trees into those holes. But I've finished all the negotiations, now I understand. Now I'm going to pay you per tree to put the trees in the ground. So we agreed on that, and then 20,000 trees go in the ground. And that probably took a total of probably a few months to get all this done.
Okay.
From start to finish, from day one of the seedlings arriving to getting them all on the ground in rows with these triangles. It's so labor intensive. Yeah. Everything here is so, so labor intensive. It takes a very long time. But finally, it was done. Fantastic. I'm excited. Everyone's excited. We're good to go. And that's really kind of how the whole thing got off the ground.
Yeah, that's amazing. And you did learn how soon after that there's a different value for Robusta versus Arabica. And what was your farm composed of?
Yeah, that's a whole different one. So I didn't, again, this is my lack of knowledge, my ignorance in the coffee world. I actually planted half of the estate with Arabica and half with Robusta, assuming whichever one grew quicker or was more resilient would be the one I would keep. But the coffee cycle is like a 10-year cycle. So then you'd have to wait 10 years before you make the decision, which you can't wait 10 years. And so I learned quickly that Robusta grows much better, but is worth about half as much as Arabica. So if you imagine I had 20,000 coffee trees, 10,000 Arabica, 10,000 Robusta, I had to now go back to the same people and say, guess what? You have to go down and dig up 10,000 Robusta trees and take those to your own farms and put those in your farms with your Robusta so it doesn't, you know, it goes to good use. And now I need 10,000 more Arabica in the ground.
Okay.
So that was the same thing over again. So yeah. After this took, I mean, this all said and done, about a year and a half, 2 years. So after 2 years from start to finish, we finally had 20,000 Arabica trees in the ground on the coffee estate, ready to go.
That's amazing. And now you're selling your coffee?
Yeah.
And you know, where are you selling it? And where can people find it? And what's coming in the future for your coffee?
Yeah. So it takes about 5 years to get a really good harvest off the trees. So we had this 2 years of getting everything in the ground and then three more years. So we're up to year five now. And the coffee's ready for harvest. And again, I needed to learn what to do. But I didn't know whether the coffee was good or bad. And it turns out, thankfully, the coffee's really good. The soil up here is beautiful. The climate is beautiful for coffee. Consistent rainfall, consistent sunshine, just a great part of the world for growing coffee, and volcanic. So the coffee is really, really good. So I realized that there was quite a big market for the coffee. And what we started doing was finding people around the world who were interested in putting this in their coffee shops and putting this in their cafes and putting this in their homes, and then reaching out to these people through different exporters and importers. So what we do now is we ship most of the coffee to Europe, Middle East, and Canada, and then it goes to different roasteries all over the world. So actually, a funny thing, a friend of mine who I'd met here in Uganda a couple of days ago sent me a WhatsApp message, and she's in Jakarta for a conference in Indonesia, and she's got a bag of my coffee. King of coffee grown, washed in Uganda, Southwest, on my coffee estate. And she's like, is this yours? I said, yeah, it's mine. She said, it's in Jakarta. I said, amazing. So the coffee's gone from this small corner of the world to the entire world, which is incredible.
Yeah, and in what, 10 years?
Yeah, 10 years, 9, 10 years. I mean, it's now almost a decade, actually. It's crazy, almost a decade of my life doing this.
Wow.
Wonderful stuff. So what's next is I've opened a cafe in Canada. And the idea now is, instead of having the coffee go from my coffee estate to person A, person B, person C, person D, all the way down to person, you know, X or Y, Z, whatever it is, I want the coffee to go from me and my company and the wonderful people I work with here in Uganda to, again, me in Canada.
Yeah.
And so we're shipping our first, we're air freighting our first 360 kilos of coffee in the next couple of weeks to my cafe in Canada to roast and start the Canadian part of King of Coffee.
Okay. Well, and you know, I've always wanted to go to Vancouver, so now I know where I'm coming to have a cup of coffee.
Yeah, please, please. Anytime you want, come have some beautiful coffee. It's good stuff.
It is delicious. And I don't want to leave out one important thing. You know, if I'm not mistaken, people from the community come also onto the coffee estate and they plant other crops in between the coffee.
Yes.
And yes. Talk about which crops and why that's good for coffee and how that's benefiting the community.
Yeah, that's a fun project. We've been doing this since I learned about it. So there's certain crops that are really good for the soil and good for coffee, and G-nuts, which are peanuts to the North American and European audience. They're called G-nuts here. I think they actually taste better here than they do back home. They're great. A little bit of, you roast them up, put a bit of salt on them, they're fantastic. But you can grow them in with the coffee, and they put nitrates back in the soil, which the coffee needs to grow. So what we do is, it's this agreement with the farmers. They come and we sit down together and say, you get 1 acre or half an acre of land, and in that half an acre there's 400 coffee trees. And what I need you to do is to, you can farm pea nuts or beans for the, because they're good for the soil and good for the farmers as well. And the land, you can use it as long as you need, but you have to maintain the integrity of the land. Keep the weeds down, keep the insects out of there, because we're a fully organic coffee estate. No chemicals, no sprays. It's all done by hand.
Yeah.
And so either I would have to get people from the village to come dig up, or this way, they get a free piece of land to grow the crops, and they're really happy to have that because the land is quite at a premium here. And so people can come, use the land, grow the crops, take those to market, make some money, support their family, and at the same time, they support the coffee estate, which actually supports the community anyway. So yeah. They're supporting them themselves, they're supporting me, I'm supporting them. It's a really nice kind of symbiotic relationship.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And tomorrow, I get to go to the estate, and I get to harvest coffee.
Mm.
And pluck it right off of the tree,
yeah,
right? Or the
yeah.
bush. Is it a bush?
Tree.
It's a yeah. tree. Okay. Tree. I'm the biologist. I don't know the difference, huh? Uh-huh. Of a tree and
I'll
a bush.
I'll educate you. Don't worry.
Okay.
I got you covered.
And yeah. so I just also want to let everybody know that if you come to Bwindi, there is an opportunity to go and visit your farm and have a coffee experience and harvesting and learning about all of these things and then having a delicious cup of coffee.
Yeah, it's fantastic. So people, a lot of times the people like yourself who are up here for volunteer work, staying in various lodges or whatever, they'll come out and do a coffee safari. So you get to pick the coffee off the tree, and then we teach you the steps from the coffee cherry. It's called a coffee cherry, the bright red one on the tree. So it's the steps from the coffee cherry all the way to the cup of coffee you drink at the end of the experience.
Yeah.
So you get to do the A to Z of coffee. And it's so much fun because you get to actually do it yourself. You pick it, you float it, you wash it, you dry it, you grind it, you roast it, the whole thing. And it really, I think one of the coolest things is people drink coffee all over the world every single day, billions and billions of cups, but hardly anybody understands all the steps it takes to even make that one single cup of coffee. So
yeah.
when you come out and you do this thing, you realize that like to go from the tree to the cup is so many steps. And it's such a cool thing to do. It's such a good little education. And at the end, you get to drink the coffee that you picked and roasted and take it home with you.
Yeah.
It's a fantastic day.
Yeah, I'm excited. You know, Kingsley, I'm so grateful I got the chance to meet you.
Mm.
And thank you so much. I know you've been really busy while you're here because you're not here all the time. You come in and you get a lot of things done and
yep.
you're getting ready for your first major shipment to your own coffee shop, which is so exciting.
So exciting. I can't wait for that.
Yeah. So thank you for taking time to talk with me.
No, thank you for the time. It's been really nice to meet you. I'm glad we bumped into each other up here. I've loved every second of it. And thank you for this
yeah.
interview in this beautiful, beautiful part of the world.
I know. And folks can find information about your coffee and follow you. Put everything on the show notes.
Yeah, great.
And then we'll make sure we're also following your first coffee shop.
Yes, very, very soon. The next few months, it'll be up and running. So,
okay.
Can't wait.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm not joking when I say that Kinga Coffee is some of the best I have ever had. The only exception was Blue Mountain Jamaican Coffee, and there are many similarities in where that coffee is grown, especially the volcanic soils. Another thing Kingsley and I share is the gravitational pull Uganda, and Bwindi in particular, has on us. For me, it's my research on the mountain gorillas and other projects under development. That gravitational pull includes the people, working with them, getting to know them, and being welcomed by them. That means for some, like myself and Kingsley, when you come, you don't want to leave, and you look for ways to build something of value with the community. I hope to be working here for many years to come. And although this is the official end of the Voices of Uganda special series, there will be more episodes featuring people here, what they're doing, and the impact they're having. If you want to follow the journey of Kinga Coffee, you can find all of the links on the show notes. And you can find the show notes on my website, jennifervertelin.com, or on the podcast website, Wild Connection, the podcast on Podbean.
I want to take a moment to thank all of the listeners for supporting this series and the podcast. And I hope you will continue to support the podcast by giving it a like and sharing it with your friends. I'm also grateful for the opportunity to be a Fulbright Scholar, to come to this corner of the world, engage in this work, and develop new projects. I'm still on my Fulbright, and I'm developing and launching a new mountain gorilla research program. More on that in the future. I'll also be excited to share with you what the outcome of my Fulbright project has been, aside from this podcast series. Now, next time we are back with a celebration of orcas, or killer whales. Now, they have been in the news lately, so I talk with killer whale biologist and author Hannah Strager about her new book. All right, everyone, thanks for listening.